probably the second person I've talked to extensively about what went on, you know, who had a knowledge of things that happened. Another guy writing something on Marvin, on the Player Association from Missouri.
Chuck Korr.
K-O-R-R. He's a in the history department or something at the school there in St. Louis. Anyway, he had asked me a few of these questions.
I'd like to talk about Curt Flood.
Okay.
You were a player rep still in the Puerto Rico winter meetings when Flood came down.
Right.
What do you remember about his appearance for the player reps?
We knew he was coming, obviously. They talked about it. Marvin had talked to us before he got there. Marvin didn't know that he had a good lawyer first, which he didn't think he did. He talked to us about that. He felt that if he lost this case, that it could seriously hurt us all. So when Kurt came in, he gave a good account of himself, talked, did very well. Some of us have known him, anyway. I didn't know him personally, I played against him, and told us what he was going to do, what he wanted to do, what it was. He didn't have enough money for the situation. So we agreed to back him financially. So that's basically what we did, and we decided that Marvin told us that he may lose, and he did, but it set a real precedent. You know, I think it awakens a lot of people, and we were impressed enough that I think we voted unanimously to support it. It was a tough time. Again, it seemed like we had a lot of scary things that went on, you know, through that time, that he was actually going to do this. We're actually going to fight the boss.
Yep.
And I already felt that he was right in doing what he did. But there still was that thing of not knowing how it's going to end up and how it could affect the rest of us. And that some players even had the idea that we didn't need free agency anyway. You know, things were okay the way they were. So, the player reps, after listening to him that day, and then also Bowie came in that same day, I think, and talked to us. I think that's when we had a meeting with Bowie, where we informed Bowie that you're not our representative, Bowie. You're a fine man. You're a good owner's representative. Be proud of it. But you do not represent the players. And we had two good meetings that day, one with Kurt and one with him. But I forget who did Kurt end up getting. He ended up getting a good lawyer.
Arthur Goldberg.
Yeah, Arthur Goldberg ended up being his lawyer, and we had financed that.
Before Marvin Miller came on the scene, nobody really dreamed of fighting the reserve clause.
Not in 100 years. My college coach, who, bless his heart, played a year or so pro ball. When I went in to play professional baseball, he told me, he said, don't be a clubhouse lawyer. Keep your mouth shut and play ball. That's basically what you were told from the word go. Don't be a clubhouse lawyer. Don't come in and fuss about things before, just play ball, you know, enjoy it. And I guess that's the mentality that we have for the most part. That's what you did. But,
I see you have Flood's book.
Yeah.
And I've read it a couple of times now. It's a remarkable document, isn't it?
First two-part book, you know, and it's a good history book, and part of it. Mm-hmm. Of course, his career is one part of it, and the other part is the things that happened to him. It is. And I enjoyed the book. As soon as it came out, I bought one. I normally wait to come out in soft cover, so I don't have to pay the full amount, but I wanted to read that one right away. And I bought Marvin's book last year since it came out.
Yeah. Flood said, in the hierarchy of living things, players are like poultry.
Yeah, in some ways, that's it. But we're numbers. It's. I can't think of any pro sports that you're not going to get discarded. You know that you are a thing. As a matter of fact, the most successful franchises really do not have any of the people who make the deals and do the things. Don't want to be close to the players. They don't want to know. Because then it clouds, you know, you can be totally objective on just on performance and what you can do for us and how you can help this organization in dealing. get to know somebody, you know they've got a wife and four kids and they're a pretty good person, and maybe they're having a bad day or a bad year or maybe two bad years, you know, and you're going to get rid of them. And you're not thought, you're thought of more like George Steinbrenner would like for his players to be. Like, if he pays $1 million for a piece of machinery, it's got to work. If he pays $1 million for a ball player, you know, he's human. He may not get a hit every time he's fast. But that machinery's going to make a weld in the same spot each time. You know, if you pay all that money for it, it's going to work or something. When he makes his boats, but players don't work that way.
Some writers suggest that's one of the problems with the Red Sox, the Yawkey years.
It was. I think it does have an effect. If I'm a general manager, maybe I don't want to know my guys as well, because then I'm involved personally. As long as I can be objective and away from it, I can probably make better deals for the team without being involved in a person's personal life or whether I like him or dislike him. And I'm sure it does cloud sometimes. And I'm sure if you are very pro-owner, or had been at that time, and maybe you might get more consideration at that time on whether we cut you or keep you another year or do this sort of thing. But poultry, and I don't know about poultry, but that's that's pretty low. Where did Orwell put the chickens back in the scheme of things? I can't remember.
How that farm?
They couldn't have been too, too high up.
Yeah. In 69, there were several celebrated cases of players using a retirement ploy to fight trades. Don Clendenin was one. That whole fiasco with the Rusty Staub trade between Houston and Montreal. That whole fiasco. And then Ken Harrelson, early in the season, got traded and fought it. Got a lot of money. And then Maury Wills retired from the Expos and got himself traded back to the Dodgers. That was about the only leverage
there was.
Had then,
yeah,
right?
I guess that's true. You know, when you think about it, because really, I held out with Ralph Houck with the argument the first year I'm with the Yankees in '63, we win the pennant. We play in the World Series. We got beaten 4 games. Next year, he's going to give me a $1,000 raise. Because the series only went 4 games and we didn't make any money. As I sat here, I'm telling you. So I kept the letters that I've written, and I've written a lot of letters over the years. I'd start off with one light letter, then one a little bit heavier, then ask for a bunch, and then make my final stab, you know, in the fourth one. But I liked that when I kept that letter, when he said we didn't make enough money because we won a series and only went 4 games. I said, oh boy, this is going to be tough. But,
well, I was in the George Weiss tradition.
Weiss
in the 50s.
Oh, he was horrible. He treated, yeah. Poor old Moose Gowron. He had two guys. You had Andy Carey and Moose Gowron. Moose Gowron got hit better and drove in more runs than Andy Carey every year, and Andy Carey made twice as much money as Moose. Because Moose would hit 300 and drive in 90 runs, and they'd offer him the same contract because he didn't hit 350 or something, you know. That's exaggerating. But anyway, Moose would call back and say, I'm not going to sign. They'd say, Moose, you know, we're paying you a lot of money. You didn't do this or that. Sign the contract. Moose would sign the contract. Okay, Andy Carey would bust and argue with him, and he got more money. And who was the best ball player? You know, and the players used to tell me about it. They said, well, Moose Gowron was, you know, carried the ball club a lot. And Andy was a good ball player, but he was a third baseman that wasn't an impact player. And that happened a lot, you know, with George Weiss. And another thing, too, that a lot of us don't realize, that when you get X number of dollars to sign all your for your personnel, and you don't use all of it, you got a percentage of what they say.
Yeah, I know.
So that, you know, and we never knew that kind of stuff.
That's outrageous.
Oh, and they did that stuff a lot. And Branch Rickey probably was the worst in the world. You know, the man credited with a lot of good things, and he did some good things. But boy, did he, you talk about meat markets, I mean, he had one.
Someone else told me about
he
Rickey.
He kept players, kept them in his organization that could have been playing, you know, in the major leagues, other places, just stockpile people. And
yeah, he had done that in the 30s with the Cardinals until Landis freed hundreds of them, emancipated them.
Yeah. You were free! But it's...
Ralph Alston was one of them.
Was he really?
Alston, Gee, in the minor leagues, I think he drove in 100 runs 4 or 5 times, hit 25, 30 home runs year after year, but he was stuck behind Bottomley, and then Rip Collins, and then Johnny Mize. He was a first baseman. And,
nice group to be behind, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. The Hall of Famers. And so he got one at-bat in the majors.
Yeah.
But he was his stats in the minors, if you ever see him, outstanding. When Flood retired rather than go to Philadelphia, was there any sense that, well, these other guys have been retiring and just getting more money?
There was a lot of things involved with that. Flood was black. Okay. So some people inferred that because, you know, he was black, he should be happy he didn't play him in the major league and making that kind of money. There was some racism involved in this. And he wasn't that good a ball player anyway. You know, that's the next thing that comes around. I know. That's the next thing that comes out. Well, he's not that good. And the guy's a good ball player, and he's very smooth, and he's a good ball player. And then because he's black, he doesn't appreciate it. We still had the plantation philosophy, you know, on a lot of people. Unfortunately, that was still around. And just what you said, hey, why does he think he's better than these other people who've had to go? You know, we've had other people traded, and they go on. And he had to fight a lot of things. And we were really upset. Not upset with him. I think I was disappointed when he finally retired after he, who did he go play for?
Senators.
Of course, Senators might put you in a bad slump at that time, but he didn't play long and he quit.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks.
Right. Came back and played a little bit and hung it up.
He said he just lost it.
Yeah, he did. And he went back and was an artist, which he was before anyway, but... he had a lot of things going against him. If he would have been a white man with a big stature, same stature he had, it would have been easier. And I don't want to bring a racist thing in there, but it was. I mean, I heard that.
You mentioned earlier that you would have considered joining that suit.
After he did that and started his suit, you know, that winter, after the 70 season, when the White Sox and the Cubs pulled that perceived by me shenanigans that they did, because there was no earthly reason in this world that the White Sox were playing this. They're in last place. They're paying three managers. They had Al Lopez, who was still playing. I think Payne, Don Gutteridge, who they just fired, and Chuck Tanner, who had just taken over. So they pay a lot of managers, but you know, they're bringing me on a club that has nowhere to go. It was 106 ball games or 108 that year. I'm not sure what it was. They're going to go with a youth movement next year with Chuck Tanner coming in. They're not going to be a contender. Why'd they want a 37-year-old left-hander relief pitcher? They didn't. You know, I was kind of guy without a team the next spring. You know, I go down there and I look at what's going on, and I'm not in the plans. And it became even more apparent. I mean, when I see the left-hander from the Cubs over there, a young kid, okay. But at that point, I had no proof. I did not want to go through the thing of getting a lawyer, and plus I wanted to play another year, so.
Now, were you what later became known as a 10-5-year man by then?
Didn't have any success.
Right, they didn't have it then.
No.
If you had been, would you have vetoed it?
I did not have 10 years in at that time. I did have 5 years with the Yankees, but I had 8 years. I was not a tenure man, but I fell right on the edge of it. Yeah, I would have. When the trade is a waiver, I never hear of anybody getting picked up on waivers anymore.
No, you don't.
I still do it. yeah, you know, so that's not a... I made $36,000 my top salary. I made it the last 2 years, same salary. At that time, the average salary was around $28,000.
It had already doubled. 3 years after Six Miller came in.
The average?
The average was 13, 66, something like
been.
That.
Might have been, because when I came in, $7,000 was minimum, so I think it was.
Yeah.
And I started off in that.
About emerged 15 or 20, and they called him a communist.
That's it. I mean, he talked about a lot of things, about raising the salary, and everybody knowing what everybody else made. And I know one year, for us to try to get it, I went with the Yankees, called them all, we had a meeting. I said, I'm not asking you guys to put your names on it. Please take a piece of paper, write your salary on it, fold it up, however you want, put it in the hat. We need to do this. I explained to them.
That was Miller's idea, yeah.
Yeah. We need to know salary so we can find out what we're talking about here and what kind of outlay. We can't listen to the press, you know, or the owners. They won't give it out, and sometimes they give out the wrong ones. So we did, and we got a pretty good response in that. I knew who the $100,000 was when they popped it in there.
Right.
But anyway, so that I paid $5,800 for a van that was loaded. Now the same van cost me $25,000. They had a little more on it than that one did, but you know, so $36,000 was good, man. You know, I didn't owe any money. I paid all my bills. Didn't live high or whatever, but can't even imagine that. I know my wife asked Gene Michael, whose son came down and pitched for me a couple of years on the college team, and Gene was down here one day, and she wanted to know if Gene lived over in the area where we did, closer, in New Jersey, up in Northern Valley. And so Gene, who's living in our house now, the one we used to rent for the summer, and he said, you got to understand, they don't live in houses like that anymore. We paid like $500 a month, $600 a month. He said, they don't live in those houses anymore, Shirley. They live in really nice houses. Okay.
Wow. Over an Englewood Cliffs or something.
Yeah, right. Over really. And some of them buy them. You know, buy and sell them. Kiss of death is buying a house. Every time somebody bought a house, they got traded.
Yes, I've met a couple of those folks.
Tommy Trash bought a house. Ridgewood, I think. Me. I traded
to
Detroit.
Detroit.
Yeah.
See it. And Bobby Wine. Bobby Wine bought Tommy Lasorda's house in Norristown. And He wasn't even traded. He was given to Montreal.
Given?
Larry Jackson was drafted by Montreal in the expansion, and Jackson chose to retire. And the last day of spring training in 69, Wine was awarded to the Expos.
He was the player.
he was happy to go to Montreal, he told me, because he thought a lot of Gene Monk, so he went with Monk, who was his mentor. But meanwhile, he had just bought this house in Norristown. In 69, Al Downing had the audacity to hire an agent to do his negotiating, and got a kick out of reading. I don't know if it was Jim Ogle or not. I think it might have been in the Times, with little squibs in his column about Downing's negotiations. He was coming off a sore arm. Ogle wrote one time, Downing, who won three games for the Yankees in 1968, is being offered, whatever it was, $26,000 by the Yankees. His agent is asking for $38,000. Downing is believed to be siding with his agent.
Ogle. I don't know if Ogle ever wrote an objective piece in his life. Yeah, he used to say, he used to come around to me because I was a player rep all the time, and he never had the same views, you know, but if he's writing an editorial, that's okay. If you're writing about games or something, don't throw that crap in, which he did. But anyway, we used to rag over because he was always, now he's the director of alumni, Yankee alumni. He's the one that determines who comes to the old-timer games. That's why I go once every 4 years, you know, or 5 years. I go every year. Not when we stay with people, but... he used to say, how can you guys do that? And you got somebody who's not a baseball person going to negotiate for you. I said, Jim, I don't have a degree in business. I don't negotiate things. I don't know how much money they've got to offer. I'm going in and talk to a guy who knows how much money he can offer me. And if he saves any, great, that's feather in his cap. And he's negotiating. He's professional. This is what he does. I play baseball. I throw baseball. Sometimes well, sometimes not well. But that's what I do. And this guy, what he does is negotiate. So you're sending an amateur in to play a professional. And at that time, I thought agents were a good idea, but I never made enough money where I felt like I could afford an agent. I didn't know if I was going to Maybe I made a lot more if I'd had an agent. But Al went forever on potential. Once you got potential, you can keep playing. Downey never won as big like they thought he would, but he threw well. He had potential. As long as you got potential, you can make some money.
Yeah. Yeah. The Yankees really gave up on him in 69, and they came back and had the strong years for the Dodgers.
That's right. He really did. What an unusual young man.
Found out he had narcolepsy.
Oh, we knew. We used to rag him all the time. Before a game, he'd been here sleeping on the training table. You go on the train, he'd sleep, or the bus, he'd sleep everywhere, and we'd get on Al. And then, yeah, he did. And that's, you go back and see it now, you know what was wrong. I didn't know what was wrong with him at the time. We just thought, oh, he's laid back. We're getting ready to pitch in a big ball game, and he's in there on the training table, sound asleep. So this guy can really relax.
Yeah. Yeah. He went for an arm exam at the Mayo Clinic. They found out he was narcoleptic. He said, that's why I keep falling asleep on dates.
I really liked Al. I did. He was one of the guys.